Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jacob Barrett, and today I have the pleasure to be talking with Richard Newton and Vaia Tuna about their new edited volume, Field Notes in the Critical Study of Religion, Revisiting Classical Theorists, that was just published in May 2023 with Bloomsbury Publishing. Richard and Vaia, welcome to the podcast, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
This is great. I've been looking forward to this. So glad it's coming together.
So the first thing I wanted to ask you about is kind of the origin story of this volume. How did it come to be? I think it's such an interesting contribution to the field of kind of method and theory and visiting this canon. So how did the volume come to be? And when you were first putting it together, what were the aims and goals of this volume?
So who goes first? Is there, we take turns?
Yeah, whoever. Yeah, jump in.
As I was telling you previously, I was listening to Leslie and Stephen the other day on the podcast they did with you about their new book. And like they said, there is more than one origin story. I bet you hear that all the time with every book conversation you're having. And also, not only that there may be multiple origin stories, but where do you place the, you know, where do you pinpoint the origin of that came to, you know, become a book? To when we started talking about the book, or when we met within the context of Culture on the Edge? Or I think, for me, I don't know what Richard thinks. Certainly, Culture on the Edge blog post have the first seeds of what I think we came to envision as our book in some way. I think because they were also, those blog posts were trying to take a social cultural example, whether, you know, mundane, everyday, or scholarly sometimes, and trying to complicate it, which in some way is what we are trying to do in this book. Only the example now is what we refer to as classical scholars. And I think I say that in the preface to the volume. The book came out of discussions that we have had over the years with colleagues, as well as our experiences in classes, especially graduate courses. I think, you know, Richard has a lot more to say on that. But the common denominator in all these was our observation that our, not observation, observation obviously, but something that we didn't like in the way that we were approaching those classical scholars, what we came to, you know, talk as classical scholars. And I think, I'll leave Richard talk about this. Richard was already having a discussion with Russell McCutcheon on this. And, you know, like many projects that are coming out of our department, Russell is plays a significant role. And I was drawn into that discussion with Richard and Russell about this whole thing and how do we approach scholars, classical scholars. And I think he sort of encouraged us in his own way to turn our frustration into something more concrete, to a book. And here it is. I think that's how I would sort of describe the origin story. But, you know, I want to hear also from Richard.
Yeah, I think the genesis of the book is as Vaia said, not one single thing. And in fact, it's recognizing perhaps the desire to model a different way of doing scholarship, particularly the sort of method and theory vein, than what I was seeing in the classroom. And I think Vaia, as she said as well, what we see in the classroom, but also what we see in sort of academic guilds, around the work that we do in the study of religion. So for instance, a lot of times the move to advanced scholarship looks like, who have you read? Are you reading the latest, greatest, most sophisticated, edgy, provocative thinker who's just come out with some sort of thesis? And have you rejected the past, seeing it as problematic and shameful and something that you should disassociate yourself from as quickly as possible? And if you haven't read the past to know it well enough to dismiss it, or read the latest, greatest thing to be up on it, then you're not really doing scholarship. And I think what Culture on the Edge, the blog posts, the volumes have done really well is to model a way of making space for thinkers to sort of showcase how they're approaching something, a piece of data, but also what are they bringing to bear on that piece of data to open a conversation and exchange that makes it more than any particular single method, any particular single datum, and into how do we make sense of what human beings are doing. And when you take the datum of scholars of religion, we have some interesting things to talk about. I have seen in a lot of volumes, contemporary volumes included, an effort to sort of find a new canon. Like, let's go find the people we should be reading and should be assigning on lists of readers for how to do scholarship well. So imagine yourself to be a graduate student. Here's the list you're handed before taking examinations. Know these people. And I think there are sort of classic thinkers that we often teach people to engage, but we've also said, well, who should we be reading instead, either for sort of post-colonial reasons or matters of representation? And the thing in particular that frustrated me about that approach is the sort of arrogance that comes with saying, don't read this person because they're from such and such time, they look such and such way, and they said such and such thing. When you can, it doesn't take much to imagine that one day, especially if you've had students, one day they'll read your past stuff and say, well, they're from such and such time, such and such place, looked like this and did, you know, were part of this moment. Shouldn't we just reject them wholesale? I think what we hope to model is a certain sort of generosity, but also curiosity about how do we actually listen to what we're saying? How do we become more observant of the people around us and the things we're studying? And what is that, what sort of opportunities does that have for us in the academic study of religion and beyond? And I think this volume was a way to not only do that individually, but to do that collaboratively across a lot of different boundaries that keep us doing our academic work in very particular ways. So it was kind of a grand experiment to see what would happen if we shifted the paradigm a bit.
Yeah. And I think this, what I think is really interesting about this volume is it is in that kind of twofold approach to, or, you know, I think you used the word frustration, like the frustration with approaches to the canon as either rejecting it outright and saying, well, we shouldn't be reading these people and we need to just, you know, dismiss them and find new voices, or what I think Vaya writes in the preface is that that it's that, and it's also a frustration with the canon being held as kind of this timeless authority that we just, you know, accept fully, that it's either a full dismissal or a full acceptance of. And I think this volume does an interesting job in trying to complicate both of those and hold them both in tension and say, what if we acknowledge, you know, that these are foundational works in our field, and so we should be engaging with them and taking them seriously, but also, you know, not falling victim to the kind of the timelessness and the assumed authority that these texts and these thinkers have. I guess my question kind of along those lines is, more explicitly, you know, we've talked about it a little bit in your explanations of what your goals for this volume are, but how do you feel, like, what do you think this volume does differently in regards to kind of putting forward a list of canonical thinkers in the field? What does this volume do differently than other kind of approaches to list out a canon for religious studies?
Right. Well, first of all, I want to make a clarification, perhaps.
Yeah.
in the way I see it, anyways. I oftentimes I speak like with a plural, assuming that Richard gets along with it. So we don't. I don't think we've seen this volume as an attempt to create a canon. Back to Field Notes. It is our selection of scholarly codes, and by extension, of course, classical scholars. And we were not interested in presenting or simply describing their work, their contributions to the field, whether negative or positive. I think we left that to the contributors. Sure, some of that is still there in the volume, but the instructions we gave to the contributors were to demonstrate in their pieces a critical approach, a different method. And by that we meant, you know, a way of analyzing those scholarly codes, how to showcase for others, you know, the general public, our students, how to engage with ideas, or how to complicate ideas that may still persist in the field. We asked them not to. I remember I was trying to find actually earlier the first emails that we sent to our contributors. And there we asked them specifically not to spend too much on the work of the scholar that we're handling, of course, to contextualize, but rather to focus on the code that they were or they have been assigned. Because I think for me, you know, the past is never really about the past. So when we engage with these scholars, it's never on their own terms. It's never really about them. So if we take that seriously in our work, what we will be producing, that's what the volume, I think, is trying to do. What does it mean to engage with the past, with where past now is classical scholars, in terms of the present, in a manner that is critical, that is engaging, that that was our prompt to the contributors. And I think the result of doing such an exercise in this volume was, at least to me, but maybe I'm biased, was far more interesting and engaging than to simply either, you know, dismiss or praise a scholarly work. Because in a way, it's not really about these scholars, but it is about us, current scholars, current scholarship, and how we negotiate with current trends within the field, or, you know, current approaches, ideas, you know, method and theory, and in relation to those classicists. So that's what I think for me is what is different to this in this volume.
Yeah, I mean, I think the volume to me is actually uninteresting if you're looking to understand classical theorists on their own terms. Like, what's a novel approach to Durkheim? You know, like, what can I find something Durkheim said that I didn't know he said? Like, that's useful. But I'm so much more interested, even to this day, having read the volume and seen the contributions come in and the conversations around it, I'm far more interested in how do people work with these texts that often they've been told either they must read or they can't read and shouldn't read, you know, both of which are sort of, they're two sides of the same coin, the must read, don't read situation. And so, you know, if you want to take the idea of canon, I think it's important, as Vaya said, like not to think of this book as a canon of must read, don't read, but rather an observation that these are names of people in constituting a sort of classic past for the field, not exhaustively, but names that show up. What is it that scholars do with it? And you, I think, mentioned the need to take these people seriously, take these scholars and their work seriously. Often there's no follow-up with what does it look like to do so? And I think what it doesn't look like for sure is an appraisal of are they good or bad? As if people wake up trying to, wake up deciding to be villains, in the morning, like, ooh, I'm going to do evil today. I don't think that's how human beings actually work. Instead, I think what the volume models in each chapter in the sort of the book endings with the essays on either side, it models an approach to the question that we always face when we are doing scholarship and imagining a present and future, to be honest. And that is, are these works that came before, works that I engage because they are sort of data for me, or are they sort of interlocutors with whom I'm conversing to arrive at better questions and answers about the thing I'm studying? And I don't think there's a single clear-cut answer. And the way that our contributors were working through that was what really is exciting and what I hope readers take away as, like, oh yeah, like, how would I go about doing this? Because when you're doing that, then I think you're doing a sort of generative scholarship that makes room for not just other people, but for a whole range of insights that illumine, shade, darken, but clarify and qualify all the more.
Yeah, and I think I found the chapters in the book really useful thinking from, I two falls ago now, I guess, took my department's, method and theory course where it's kind of a march through the canon and, reading all of these classical theorists. And, I know I've had conversations with peers where it's been frustrating, as grad students trying to figure out how do we, like, we have to read it, we have to read these people because they're being assigned in this class that we have to take. And we're told that this is the foundations that we need to know, but how are we supposed to use them? And how are we supposed to use them generatively? And how are we supposed to make sense of that in our own work? And do we use them, or do we just, check the box that we took that class and say that we have read them? And so this was a really useful model and exercise to kind of move through and see a huge range of scholars from working from different areas and different content places. Content areas thinking through these field notes, which was kind of the next question that I wanted to hear from you on. You've both talked about field notes. That's obviously the title of the book, Field Notes in the Critical Study of Religion. And you've both used the word observation as you've been talking. So I just wanted to know a little bit, could you unpack this field note approach that the volume takes? How is the, like, a little bit of, could you explain a little bit about the structure of the volume and why you decided to ground each essay in a field note from one of these scholars?
First of all, I want to say thank you. It was a really generous reading, and I'm really glad that the volume becomes already what we hoped it will, a model for a younger generation of the scholars like you. And basically what Richard was saying, when it comes to seeing the scholars as data, what does that actually mean to say that they are our data? And I think that's what the volume is also trying to do. If we see them as data, how are we going to deal with them? When it comes to field notes, yes, well, Richard, I see him smiling, because we really had to convince on that term to keep in the title of the volume. To me, a field note has, I mean, the why we wanted to keep that, because it works on multiple levels. First, I think it field notes refer to us, I mean the editors, Richard and I. By naming our volume Field Notes, or keeping that concept there, we wanted to place emphasis on choices that scholars are making when they are doing field work, right? You very correctly observed that we are observing. And so they are doing, scholars are doing field work. They are taking field notes. which are the result of certain questions that they have, we have, you know, as the editors, a certain interest that drive what we will write down after we are doing field work. You know, the notes we are taking where we are doing field work, which is basically what researchers, scholars want others to pay attention to. And oftentimes we assume that the group we happen to study is this coherent thing. Like, so we have the classical scholars that are the canon to the field, but in many ways we sort of make it, we make the canon. So someone may think that we're trying to make the canon, but and we make it with our questions, with our research agenda, with the interest that we have, with our choices. And so Richard and I, we did that. We made choices. We took a dive into these scholarly works and came out of the dive with a number of codes of notes, field notes, these short codes that start every contribution, basically. So again, field notes first points to the editor's choices that were then given to another group of scholars, to our contributors, and we wanted to see how they will deal with our notes, with our field notes. How would they approach those scholarly codes? How would they analyze them? And you can see actually that each piece, its contribution, its chapter brings something different to the whole enterprise or experiment, because the scholarly interest of our contributors varies because their background is different, their interests are different. So someone who reads the volume in a way is invited to pay attention to all these different levels of doing field work, of doing research, from the editor's choices to the author's choices in handling the data, right? By which we mean the codes now, the scholars, and of course the content and what we can say about those classical theorists. So I think I try to say something a little bit different to what we already try to explain and what we mean field notes in the preface. Yeah.
And I think too, the example of the sort of field exam that a student might take to prove that they understand this field called the academic study of religion is an enterprise that often leads someone to make notes on the field itself, right? Like, this is what is important. This is what people expect me to know, where I've been expected to pay attention. And I need to situate myself within that. I think what's interesting, though, about that exercise is that if you see it as mastery over the past, in terms of have you memorized the right things and read the right things, you're becoming a student of a kind, right? Who's received the tradition. But you haven't really shown yourself at all to be this the kind of academician or scholar who is creating the field and raising the questions that we might be asking that both further our knowledge, but also have us think twice and thrice about things that we thought we already knew about. And so each chapter, while I think a lot of readers will find some familiar names, I think different people find familiarity with different chapters. But you know, the Max Muellers and the Carl Jung and the Cantwell Smith and the Freud, you'll have these sort of so-called classical theorists, but we also were intentional about finding quotations that by and large are not the quotations by which these classic theorists are known, because what better way to perhaps combat the arrogance of knowing these people and these past moments so well than to be creating or fabricating a situation in which contemporary readers might be surprised by what was going on in the field. You know, I hope too that what comes across as well in each of these chapters are the extent to which contemporary authors sound a lot like these classical theorists and sound like they've made a massive departure. Because that is noteworthy in and of itself. And as we read through the collection and the individual contributions themselves, I think you wouldn't be surprised to find yourself saying the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah,
But
absolutely.
describing that more thickly and further, to me is a much more exciting approach to traversing the field, the academic study of religion. Certainly a more conscientious way of doing so.
And I think we sort of answered, semi-answered the structure of the volume, like with the 13 scholars that we invited to analyze. And also, like because we're talking of the past, I think the codes, the way that we have them, is it appears to be as fragments of the past, because they function in different. And how do we make sense then of those fragments of this one isolated code that Richard and I make a choice to isolate and bring it to our contributors? What should we be paying attention when we read that paragraph from this particular scholar? And I think that's where our contributors help in, because they point to all sorts of interesting things that we should be paying attention to, oftentimes surprising us as well. Right.
Yeah, thinking about the choices that you as editors made, right, with this field note approach to say, here's 13 classical theorists, and here's 13, isolated quotes from their work that we're taking as field notes to give to 13 different contributors to then kind of engage and respond to and think with. How did you decide what thinkers, what classical theorists to include? What were those conversations like? Did it kind of just, did you know it was going to be 13 and you tried to figure out which 13, or did you kind of get your list and say, okay, here's, well, it was 13. Like, what did that look like? Because in some sense, I remember in the preface you said all attempts to, that the many attempts to kind of list a canon all fail in some way. And that, you said earlier in this interview, like, this isn't meant to be a, well, we're putting forward a canon. So how did you come up with your list of 13 thinkers, 13 classical theorists to engage in this volume?
You're absolutely right. We were not, I said it previously, we were not interested in making a canon, far from it. Second, we were not at all interested, or so much concerned with a who question, but rather about what to include. Not that who is included is not significant, or something not to pay attention to, but we hope readers will be paying attention to the tension of the codes, to the issues that they bring to light, as well as the way by which our contributors are dealing with those codes, right? The way we did it, first of all, it has been a while since we actually did this. So we decided, I believe early on, Richard, correct me if I'm wrong, that the volume will have about 14 chapters. So then there was, we were not, doing an edit volume is quite different than writing a volume, like Leslie and Stephen did. So it is easy to divide tasks, easier. And it's easy to divide tasks because we were on many ways on the same page with Richard, and it who makes it so much more easier to work with, and on a collaborative project. So we kind of knew, we discussed, we had discussion in our offices of what we wanted and what are some of our criteria. So deciding on being 14 chapters, we did wanted to use those codes. We said, all right, let's, you take half, I'll take half, or I'll come up with half. And we took the dive. I remember I was going through scholarly works, codes that I have throughout my years in, studying and all that, that I had underlined. Some, of course, going back, they now seem different, right? But one criterion that was that we wanted to find something that we wouldn't expect this scholar to say, or an issue that we thought that we are dealing with now, and therefore is new, but actually they were also dealing with it, like this older generation. Of course, the question is how they dealt with it and how we're dealing with it. And for some of the codes, I was honestly, like, going back to the scholars, I was thinking, are we really moving forward, or are we making circles? And we think we are being innovative, but are we really innovative? For the way that we paired the code to the contributors was not necessarily based on the familiarity we thought the latter might have of the classical scholar in question. In fact, we, as I say also in the preface, we tried as much as possible to steer away from doing that to the extent possible, so that they can bring a different perspective in their analysis to the code, to the scholar and to the code. And also, like, ideally, it was more so what the code was hinting about intentions within the field, and less about the scholar.
Yeah, I
And
was gonna...
that's how we ended with what we ended. So I didn't say any names. I was not interested in who I was looking at, and there were a lot that I wish we had the space to include.
I think
Yes.
the limitations of a volume, right, where you can't cover everything,
Yes.
to me is actually quite exciting and productive, because the hope is that someone could come along and say, well, how would you do this with such and such theorist that you didn't include? In terms of the sort of commonalities maybe of the people we listed, none of them are alive currently. I think Cantwell Smith died in 2000. So the scholars, the sort of classical scholars, had their time in the 20th centuries and prior. And also, we wrote the volume, we at least started the volume, really in the pandemic, and it was very much international. So the way the pandemic manifested was sort of varied, no doubt impactful, but varied among our experiences. But that was also sort of part of what we were contending with as well, and the type of work that you can produce in such a setting. And even when someone, I think like Vaya said, like when someone may have had some familiarity with a scholar, they quickly were defamiliarized with said scholar by way of either the quotation that we presented them with, or the task of moving past the biography of the scholar and into what do you do with this work as you are navigating through the field that is the academic study of religion, which I think is a real challenge because it's not something we ask scholars to do very often is what do you do with this thinker, not with this datum as I'm an area specialist in this per in this place on the globe or on this part of the timeline, but rather this person who at some point constitutes your sort of academic lineage, what do you do with it? Are you building on it? Are you departing from it? And it's I think it can be circles in terms of the similarities and differences, but also sometimes we sort of round our way back to round our way forward. And to see where that takes us, to me was intriguing, because when we started the volume, I think I thought of the volume as, where I spent a lot of time thinking about the volume in terms of the scholarly coverage, the sort of classical theorist involved. But on this side of the volume, now that it is out and the experience that it takes to bring it together, I don't think about Sigmund Freud or Rudolf Otto. I think about all the contributors and what they are doing in the academic study of religion and the conversation that that represents. Like, that to me is what the critical study of religion is, with an awareness that someone could come along, perhaps in their field exam, and take all the contributors to this volume and say, here's what these people are doing. Here's where I see myself within that. I would depart from this. I think what they are doing here is something we should continue. That to me is actually quite fantastic. And I couldn't ask for anything more.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. That's why I like working with Richard. That's what I was thinking also, that, you know, if we take seriously that the past is not really about the past, it's about the present, the fascinating thing about the volume is our contributors and what they have done actually with all these codes. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of on that note, I think all of the essays were so engaging, and, you know, as we've talked about, all of the contributors are coming from different areas of specialization and different contexts. As you were editing the volume, and you think back to it, are there any chapters that stick out to you as like particularly exciting, or chapters that surprised you, or helped you thought about something differently than you maybe expected to think about? Like, do any jump out and come to mind as particularly exciting or surprising?
I'll be very diplomatic, like with the Oscar and thanking everyone. but for real, I can't really separate any one of the chapters or any one of the contributors, because each contributor has done such a great work showcasing actually the breadth of the field. Every single chapter to me, especially with the codes, and I now forget, to be honest, which ones I chose. it's now very collective. We did it. But I do remember that, and of course, I made choices in the selection of the codes that had to do primarily with what I find interest or curious in the field, right? That's why, like, the codes basically speak to the editors and whatever choices they were making. The interesting thing is that whatever my choices were in selecting the code, the contributor did something far more interesting or unexpected to what I was thinking or I was going to do had I used it to make my own analysis of it. And that I find fascinating. And the other thing that I quite like about the volume is that, despite the fact that each contributor had its own code and they were working and on their own time and coming from quite a variety of subfields within the field, there is, if one is to read the entire volume, one can see the overlaps. One can see the way that we add to each other. Someone who is doing work in Middle East, someone who is doing work in Asia, or someone who is doing work in early Christianity. On the theoretical and methodological level, we see some overlaps in the questions we are asking, in the interest that we are having. And that, I think, to me was another element of surprise, of interest, of that something is it's quite interesting is going on in this volume. And I think I feel that we at some point we need to mention all the contributors, just their names. And so from Brett Nongbre to Mitch Tosi, Hori, to Christopher Jones, to Krista Dalton, to Edith Santo, to Robin Walsh, to Tenza Engel, Martha Smith Roberts, Lauren Horn Griffin, Brad Desaki, Joseph Winters, and Andrew Dobolowski, and of course,
Emily Clark as well.
Emily Clark, yes. Thank you. And of course, Russell and Aaron, who wrote the introduction. So yes, to me, each one of the contributors are special in the way that they have approached the code and what they brought into it, from description to more context analysis to to all sorts of things. But I'll let Richard.
Yeah, I was going to add to about one of the wonderful things about this volume, and I think telling things about this volume, is that these contributors, because of the way the academy is often organized and framed, these contributors likely would not be in a single volume under most circumstances, mm-hmm. right? They might not even be trained in the same type of program. There was work that had to be done to make the case that we're all doing the same thing. And I think in principle, we often say that, like, okay, we have a journal of, a flagship journal, and whether it's religious studies as a whole or the history of religions or whatever it may be, method and theory even, that the person in chapters 1 through 5 has something to say to the person writing in chapters, 9 through 13, just isn't a foregone conclusion in terms of the day-to-day practice of the academy. Why is it that we would all have different field exams, right? If you're in a PhD program, you might call it a field exam or qualifying exam, but often we're fixated on like subfields, like this little portion, like specialization is the name of the game. But to engage in some sort of enterprise that reminds us, reflects back, and frankly makes the argument for something larger going on, right? That we should be taking into consideration what's going on, irrespective of the data that we may specialize in studying, was a statement. And I'm just very pleased when I look at the table of contents of the people who got in the same proverbial room to talk about this. And the type of conversation that's going on there is way more interesting to me than the discussions going on in any one particular subfield, as great as those times may be as well. That there's something else in getting us together, and it's not just like, ooh, what do we have to talk about, gives me hope for the field. What doesn't give me hope is how hard it is often to do just that.
You're right. But the hope is, to continue that thought, the hope is that the book becomes an invitation to follow the example, but also play with it.
Yeah.
I mean, you can have the volume in your class and ask, play or analyze the code with your students, bring them up to speed with how they can sort of, with the scholar, the context, right, that comes out of a very particular period in the history of scholarly works or the field. And then once you played with it and analyze it and try to explain it with your students, then go to the contributor and see and compare how they have done it differently. And I think that's a great exercise to have in your class. That's how I think I will be using it.
Yeah, and I think this last point kind of transitions really nicely into the last question that I wanted to ask you about. One of my favorite pieces and takeaways from the book was exactly what you were talking about, Richard, kind of this larger conversation and commentary and invitation, to use Bahia's word, but this kind of argument put forward about the importance of a kind of maintaining a field-wide discourse, and the importance of bringing people from different disciplines, from different backgrounds together. In the afterword, you make the distinction between discipline and a field, and you kind of talk about that. And the volume shows that, religious studies as a field grows out of a lot of many different disciplines, and so we're kind of it's a benefit in one sense because we're thinking with a lot of different disciplines, and there's some challenges in, kind of being this multidisciplinary project. So I just wanted to know if you could speak a little bit more about kind of the larger commentary on the field that this volume points to, in relation to like why it's important for these kind of field-wide discourses to be taking place.
I think it's easy to grow satisfied with being well-tutored, well-disciplined, if you will, well-trained in a specific area. So much so that you might buy your own hype that your specialty in the single area makes you expert in the totality of the field. I think actually the posture that surprisingly enough comes out of the 19th century is that as we come to understand how big the world is, which we do time and time again, probably ebb back and flow and say, no, we've seen it all. And then we say, oh no, but look how much more there is. As we look at how much data there is, right? The explosion of data that, is often talked about. You can't possibly know everything. But what you certainly must do, and it's the same whether you have a PhD or you're an undergraduate student or you're just some kid coming on the scene, is paying attention to how do you know what you know? I think back to, I think an example from that I heard when I was an undergraduate student in a physical anthropology class, which was a class that I took by accident, was the sort of concept of phrenology. Sort of measuring of skulls and sizes, which of course has a problematic racial history and all the like. But one of the lessons learned was that physical anthropologists weren't on the same page about how to measure the same skulls. That there are a lot of like just like the idea of not being on the same page, but thinking you're having the same conversation. Went on for a long time around phrenology, let alone its implications for what it means about race and social difference and the like. The care required to make sure that you get on the same page, or that you're not seeing the same thing, even though you may be using the same words, or housed in the same institution, is inviting and challenging, and a provocation to stay curious. And I think that curiosity is a posture that is precisely what expands the field rather than occludes it. How unfortunate it would be to be looking in one direction in any given field to think that that's the whole world, right? And we also can't afford to just say, well, the world's a big place. I have nothing to say because I can't see all of it. What we can do this differently. We can hold in tension the fact that we do observe what we observe, and we should be challenged by others who see things differently and are seeing different pieces. And I think that's not something to be disciplined in. It's something to it's a provocation to accept, even though it's a challenge to ourselves and our own situations.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. And I think one that some, at least in the field, are trying quite hard to go or, swim against. And because I think we oftentimes we feel that we are isolated in our own work. or subfilled, and like what Richard was saying exactly. And we tend to either forget or we think that our work may not have relevance to others in other fields, or outside the field altogether, right? But there are things I think that unite us and are actually far more interesting and can bring us together in the same conversation. And these are the methods and the theories. These are the questions that we are posing to our data. And yes, indeed, this the codes were our attempt to exactly that, to point to certain questions that are still, we are debating within the field. And that's why I said previously that it was very interesting to see our contributors communicating with each other in their pieces, unbeknownst to them, communicating in the data or having a conversation. And that I think probably I like the most, that they were conservant, even if they didn't know they were.
Yeah. Well, thank you both. This has been a wonderful conversation, and I'm so glad to have this volume, and especially as I'm prepping for my own field exam and thinking about my exams coming this fall. I'm really excited to have a resource like this and an invitation to kind of imagine myself in these conversations and see what happens next. So thank you both for your work on this and for chatting with me today.
Thank you very much, Jacob. Good luck with your examinations. I'm glad we are of some help, and it was so easy to converse and talk with you and see you. So thank you very much for the invitation.
And you have to let us know how it goes. And anyone else who's using the volume, like in your classrooms or in your own exams or in your own scholarship, like please let us know how it's going and what you're doing with the volume, because I think that's what it's all about. Like, we don't have the last word in it. Take it and run with it.
Great. Thank you both.